Johnny Hero, where great music lives. U105.
Jim and Barry from Horse Lips are in. See you walking. Brilliant stuff. Just a wee snippet of some of the tunes from Horse Lips. Jim Lockhart and Barry Devlin are in. How are you doing, guys?
How are you?
We're doing very well, thank
Looking
you.
Well, considering the last few years saw you out on the road again.
Yeah, yeah. I'm my true age is 88, but I only look. I'm told I only look 67, which is what I claimed at my last birthday.
Beautiful man of 92.
Yeah. No, yeah. I know you had a wee rattle there for a couple of years doing a few gigs and that.
That was good fun.
I was going to say, from the point of view of the punters, everybody raved about it.
Yeah, we're still technically gigging. We're just not gigging as much.
Yeah,
we have interesting about what we're talking about during the break, but we have a tour of Germany coming up next summer, and where apparently we can play anything we like. That's an in-joke, guys. Ring in and ask Johnny about it.
So you're going to Germany, yeah?
Yeah.
Are these club gigs, stadium
gigs?
No, the
festival gigs.
Ah, the festival
which is
stuff.
Great. I mean, Germany, that was...
But listen, hold on. The expats in Germany would be enough to fill a stadium for you anyway, you know?
Yeah, but the Germans are big into Irish folk stuff. Yeah, they have been really. Like, when we were playing there, we were playing rock circuit. We were playing, like, rock clubs and rock festivals and stuff. But they, at the same time, the Germans were huge into stuff like the Dubliners and Irish folk music. And they'd been coming over here for a good few years. Like, there was... people who used to go to folk gatherings in Doolin in County Clare would always talk about the Vossen Doolins because there would be very nice young German ladies who were known as that because they were just, yeah, I Vossen Doolin.
Vossen Doolin, yes.
And so they were highly prized by traditional musicians at all times.
Yeah. You must be sort of very gratified that all these years later there's still a market. And again, the not saying strange thing for me, the eye opener is that a lot of the inquiries we get about Horse Lips are teenagers.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. But the two things, the first thing that we're really gratified is that we're here to hear about it.
That's the first thing.
And the second thing is in finding a new audience, which is, I mean, we still have the audience that we had in the late 70s,
yes.
But we have a bunch of much younger kids there's three audiences. There's the ones that we had in the 70s. Then there's a bunch of guys who are now getting into middle age who picked up on it during the days of Put 'Em Under Pressure,
yes,
when the Irish team was doing it. And now there's a new bunch of kids who have picked up on what's going on, you know, the Odyssey and the O2 and all that stuff, and have started to get back into kind of Horse Lips. So part of it's connected with the fact that vinyl is back in vogue with a certain bunch of people. So old Horse Lips seconds are interesting to go out and get. So there's
also
a collector's thing as well.
I think there's a thing about, I think people have more open ears now. I think they're less kind of fashion prone. They're less prone to being told it used to be the Enemy. If it wasn't in the Enemy this week, you absolutely couldn't listen to it on pain of death. Whereas now people... You know, you can hear music from any period. You can download it like in 2 seconds and you'll have it from any period, any genre, whatever you like. I think people are like, they're not as afraid to listen to stuff that was like,
I think you're right.
Rock,
it used to be sort of NME, Top of the Pops and the Top 40 kind of thing. But I think most musicians have conceded the Top 40 is compiled by 10-year-olds.
Yeah,
it is now.
You know, bang, Jesse J and Ollie Murs, that kind of. As you say, people no longer rely on that as the barometer of what is good or, you know, what they should be looking out for.
Because the spectrum of what's out there is so broad and there's brilliant music getting done all the time. People complain about the state of the music business, but in fact, there's brilliant stuff getting done. There's a million bands, like every housing estate, every school, every road has a bundle of bands in the garage. So like there's an incredible variety of stuff getting played and recorded, and people really know their music an awful lot better these days than they would have 20 or 30 years ago. They know
but
an
it's
awful
important
lot
not to listen to them. them, because otherwise you won't have time to listen to Horse Lips.
He's not a very good salesman, Barry. No, he's selling all these other young bands. No.
I spent nearly an hour down in the foyer going, don't talk about other bands, talk about Horse Lips and the book.
That's right. Sorry. Well, you've nothing to learn. You see, he dug the book in there. It didn't take him long.
What book would that be, Johnny? I'm out of the band.
This book is class. I mean, it really is.
Didn't he do a nice job?
Yeah. Horse Lips, Tall Tales, the official biography by Mark Cunningham. It is, I mean, I'm not saying this because you're here. I have collections of these books about, Springsteen. Yeah. I've got them about the Stones, the Beatles. I buy these. I'm an idiot. I buy music books. You know, maybe
so
you
do
yourself. This is up there with the best of them as a history of, living legends.
Yeah, but it's also a history of the times, interestingly enough. I mean, if you want to see crimes against fashion, you'll see them in there.
Oh,
but
listen,
if you want to know what Ireland looked like
and
sounded like in the 70s, it's all in there.
Some of the photographs and all are, from Blackmail Corner, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he did a lovely job of layout and book design. I mean, when this landed, I was gobsmacked because, we'd been seeing bits and pieces of it. And we knew kind of roughly the graphics that he had and the pictures that he had to deal with. But at the same time, when it actually landed on the front door, I couldn't believe what a job he had done of sticking it together. He's got if he gives up writing books, he's got a great future in book design.
In fact, we're going to now try we're going to experiment with a first in radio. We're going to have the audience have a look at the flyleaf. Now, guys, if you look very carefully, Johnny is looking at the flyleaf of the book.
I'll hold this up to the microphone.
Yeah, there you go. And isn't that extraordinary?
It's all the ticket stubs. I mean, I spent an afternoon reading those alone before I even got into them. Seriously, it's the kind of agent I am.
Yeah.
But it's just. I'll tell you, folks. Is that an A4 size? No, it's bigger than A. Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's
the same kind of shape as the Guinness Book of Records.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
All right.
That's it.
But it is
more
brilliant.
Fun at the moment.
If you want an insight, never mind horse, just into the Irish music scene, and it's a bit of history in there, but it's a brilliant, brilliant book. Look at that picture, just at random.
Yeah.
Eamon Carr with Paul McGrath. That's class, You guys mixed in the right circles, that's...
Certainly did. It is. I mean, we're incredibly proud of it. We called it Tall Tales, the biography, and we've called the CD that goes out with it biography. So what you do is you read the CD and you listen to the book. It's all part of an attempt to confuse and bewilder.
Mark Cunningham, so how did you give him permission? Was he pestering you for a while? Did you know who he was?
Mark's a Cockney lad who had become a fan of the band when he was a teenager, like in the late 70s in London, in South End. It was South End, it was. And over the years, he kind of got in touch. And then must be 10 or 12 years ago, he did a couple of interviews for Hot Press. And then he kind of expanded on them. And then he began to get in touch more. And then he did more interviews. And then he said, I think I want to write a book. So he said, really? Okay. And then it turned into this. And then he came to our houses and sort of gathered up boxes of pictures and old lyric sheets and set lists and tickets and posters and what have you. And he gathered up an amazing collection of stuff. But what I was really impressed by was how he put it together so tastefully and like it graphically. I think it looks gorgeous, if I say so myself.
No, it is. It's a brilliant book.
Mark is he's a really good musician. He's a bass player, but he's a multi-instrumentalist, and he's done some really beautiful orchestral suites, best would you believe, around Horse Lips tunes.
Yeah.
He had a band called the Marshmen, which is a sort of moving feast of English musicians. And he's done a couple of really nice orchestral suites, as I say, based around things like Charolais and the town and the stuff from the town. So he sort of ploughed this lonely furrow of being a complete Horse Lips crazed person, but on the other hand, he's actually a very sensible man. It was someone he loved.
He's a magazine publisher. He had a magazine going for a good number of years. Well, it's still going. He just sold it out, called Total Production International TPI, which is a kind of specialist mag aimed at touring rock crews. And, they want to know how many XP-1244s so-and-so's got in his rack at the front of the house. You know what I mean? It's that kind of nerd territory. But he's completely... And so he, as far as I can see, wrote quite a bit of that, edited it, produced it, designed it, you know, so yeah. he's
a good designer.
He's
a nifty designer.
I love that there's a picture, there's a whole section dedicated even to the road crew over the years. Yeah, and the roadies get their pictures and all in.
Certainly
you
know? Do.
We fought hard against that, but what can you do?
And the other thing is we've taken the coffee table book one step further. You actually, with each beautiful signed copy of the Horselips Tall Tales, the official biography, you get four wooden legs that you can screw into the so if you don't want to read it, you can balance your coffee cups on it. Don't miss this offer.
It's a lavish book, but it is brilliant. And, you know, it was one of those. I found myself skimming through it, and then I thought, no, I want to read. I'll go back to the start of that chapter kind of thing. And then you end up, you know, sitting, and there's a day gone.
Yeah, no, listen, that's really fantastic. That's exactly what we were hoping. I mean, because of the way Mark did it, the story is told by each member of the band, and we weren't consulted about what the others were saying. So it was an interesting surprise to me when I read it to find out that you know, the other guys in the band actually quite liked me and I quite liked them, which is, you know, that's not always a given with you know, Ask the Lads and the Eagles if they still really love each other, you know.
No, well, that's right. You see, sometimes that is just that's luck that happens, and it's nice, but it doesn't always. It's not always guaranteed. It's
more often than not. I mean, one of the things is we discovered, you know, in our last year in 1980, we were starting sort of pulling apart a bit. We only discovered much later that a lot of bands tour that way. You know, it's just we'd been so happy and liked each other so much and had such a consensus as to what we were trying to do that the idea that we wouldn't agree on everything really hurt. And we kind of went, yeah, well, we have to go off and do other things now, you know. So, but it was nice to come back and read the biography. In Jimmy's case, it was fantastic to read it because he can't remember anything that happened in the 70s.
This was all news to me. I mean, a lot of it came as a big surprise.
He's not joking, folks.
The 70s is, by contrast, is a closed book to me.
were there any phone calls after you'd read it saying, hey, that's not true, I never said that, or that never happened?
No, I put out a statement in advance saying that the baby didn't look a bit like me.
and the money in my case was just resting in that account.
Thank you. Follow Ted, yes, I know. But it is an entertaining read. It's very informative. I mean, it could have been a nerdy fan look, but it's not. It's a very professional look as well, you know.
Well, also because he didn't iron out stuff. He kind of let people talk. And he, do you know what I mean? Like a ghostwriter or whatever would have smoothed stuff out and made it appear kind of blandish or whatever.
Yeah.
And he didn't. It's warts and all kind of.
Hey, we're speaking, so some of this is barely literate. But, but you know that it's a human voice behind it, as opposed to, you know, somebody. I mean, there are clumsy. Certainly, in my bit, there are clumsinesses and one or two untruths. It's just snuck in there.
Yes,
but it's a real. It is like what you get is. Possibly not every ounce of the truth about Ideas on the Road, but nothing but the truth about Ideas on the Road.
It's very entertaining.
And there's a great Charles O'Connor adventure on a train, which everyone ought to read about.
Oh, I haven't read that yet.
I was surprised about him going public on that.
You know, I think they...
Oh, now you have to go and get it now, folks.
I think the Bahnhof boys might be after him.
I mean, when it all started clicking for you way back when, when did you sort of all look at each other and go, listen, this could be massive? Do you know, was there a moment when you thought, whoa, look
yeah,
how big
we
this
thought
is
that
going
right
to
at the start. It was only much later we realised it probably wasn't. I mean, we didn't. Look, put it like this, Johnny. We didn't lack self confidence. There was no objective correlative in reality to say that. You know, and one of the funny things in the book is Spud Murphy, who was our first lead guitarist before Declan, describing one of the first meetings. He said it didn't seem to bother the others much that we weren't very good.
Yeah.
and it was true.
That was the punk ethos before punk existed.
Well, that's absolutely right. We knew we'd get
that's
good.
That's our excuse.
But one of the things is that people are often limited by what they can do. And if you set the bar at what you can do, you'll always stay there.
Yeah.
We were always trying to catch up in what we could do with what we thought we could do, with the result that some of the tracks are occasionally ropey, but they're never lacking an imaginative compass. We did try imaginative scope. We always tried to go as high as we could. We didn't always achieve it. God knows we didn't always achieve it.
We didn't come out of a band scene. We weren't playing in other bands, or we hadn't been playing with other people. And so we didn't come with a preconceived set of, you know, conceptual limitations. You know,
none of us had ever been in a band before. That's the other really interesting thing. Guys who end up in the final band usually have been in four or five bands.
That's right.
But none of us had ever been in a band. Not only that, but we're all country lads. With the exception, Jim was.
Speak for yourself.
Jim was a Dubliner and therefore a thief and a vandal. Yes. But the rest is
and to be watched at all times.
At all times. Oh, it was only years later that the concept of private property became a reality with Jim, you know. But
that's why I have a house.
we were country lads, and it was our first time in Dublin, as I say, except for Jim. And so we were putting together a whole bunch of things at the same time. And so the first year and a half or 2 years was an astonishing gas. We were inventing everything as we went along, including the type of music we were playing. And, you know, you two always said that they played the music they played because they were crap at doing covers, which was true.
Yeah, yeah.
And we weren't very good at doing covers. We knew kind of where we wanted to go. We were learning the musical skills. We were also really interested in, because Ireland at the time, you know, there were three or four bands, that's all, you know.
That's right.
Rock
that's
bands. Yeah. And there was no tradition of things like design and record sleeves or any of that stuff. That
quality,
that,
I think.
That quality control thing. So we wanted our first album to be like no album that had ever come out before in Ireland. And whether you like it or you don't, that's true. It was like no album. It physically didn't look like anyone else was around. And the music was weird, but it wasn't like what anybody else was playing. And I remember the late Donald Corvin of this parish writing, who had heard about us much earlier on, and we'd done a scam where we sent all the writers a little Christmas present, and he said rather tartly, if Horslips spent as much time practicing as they spend wrapping presents, they'd probably be a good band.
He rightly decided we were chancers.
When the album came out, he said, this is the best album ever in Ireland, and I'm including Van at the time. Yeah. You know, he was a bit over the top, but that was the effect Happy to Meet and Sorry Depart had at the time. And it was, and you said the Punky Thus, it was completely DIY. We were our own record company. We had brought over the Stones
mobile.
We'd recorded it ourselves. We licensed it to the record companies, and we continued that to the end of our career. So it was just a different approach.
But that was, and again, that approach was well ahead of its time. So were you shrewd businessmen?
No, we were crap at business.
Well, I think what had happened was we had a couple of close brushes with very sharp management, where we were brought in and we were sat down and we were given very smooth offers and great promises, and we were shown the world in a handful of dust, and we said, I don't know about this. We came away and said, that doesn't kind of smell right. And so it was really through caution and not wanting to go that route that we said, maybe there's another way of doing it. And it was Michael Deaney who had joined up with him as our manager, had a background in accountancy. He was also a wild man, because when he was in Oxford at one stage, he had hijacked the Springboks touring coach in London. They were coming out of the hotel and he got into the coach, padlocked himself to the wheel, waited till they were all on the coach, and then, not knowing how to drive a bus, decided, I think I'll drive this a bit. And he started driving off through London. And at which point, because he was jerking and banging into cars and stuff, the Springboks realised that he wasn't their proper driver. And so at some stage, they started to knock him about. So he just drove fast, because he thought, if I'm driving fast, they won't actually kill me because they'll all die. So he drove faster and faster. And when he did eventually have to stop, they knocked the living daylights out of
him.
So that was the kind of background of Deaney. That was where he was coming
from. That was our manager. That was our sensible business
friend. That's the sensible guy to keep you
on the street. I have been answered.
Yes.
So he didn't know any limitations either. So but he also had a lot of accountancy smarts and knew stuff about putting business deals together that we wouldn't have known anything about, despite, in my case, having two degrees in economics. I knew nothing at all about economics.
Yeah, Barry, you would have thought you'd been safe enough with him with his degrees in economics.
Yeah, no. As you can see,
send away for those degrees somewhere?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, Frith Street, I think. It's at the University of Frith Street. No, Jim, we pinched Jim from UCD, where he was actually about to do a doctorate in the economic, the social,
social the cost of economic growth.
Economic growth. Which nobody else was doing at the time. So, look, we thought we were terrifically smart. We weren't nearly as smart as we were. And as we weren't nearly as smart as we thought we were.
We used to actually run the truck on our own self-satisfaction.
Powered entirely by our own self-satisfaction.
But this approach you're describing, recording it yourselves, licensing it out for distribution and production, that's come full circle, because a lot of acts are doing that now.
Yeah, you're right. It was punk. I mean, when punk happened, then it was back to three chords and it was back to doing it yourself. And because at the time, like back in the beginning of the 70s, there was still a huge air of mystification about the music business. And in order to actually make a record, you had to go through this huge industrial process. And it was like Victorian. It was Heath Robinson, you know.
Yeah.
And therefore, you had to have men in suits who knew how it worked. We just discovered that there were ways around that you could actually do it. And that's what the punks discovered as well, that, you know, you could go to a pressing plant and you could pay them in advance and they'd do you up 200 or 300 copies of a 45, you know.
Yeah.
We just had more cards. You know that joke about what's the difference between a jazz musician and a rock musician? Do you know that?
No.
A rock musician plays three cards to thousands of people. So we had thousands of cards, but we had a few hundred people as well. So it was, you know. So, yeah, we were saved from our own inability as businessmen by Michael Deeney, who was actually quite smart at that. And he allowed us the room to experiment. He never ever once said, why are you playing that stuff? It's dreary or it's odd. Or he kind of went, okay, this is what I've got.
The thing is, a big record company would have lifted their hands in horror at what you were doing. They wouldn't have got it. It would have been, well, will you turn this into a pop song and do away with the deedly-dee bit? And, you know, you know yourself.
And we'd have been rich.
But Johnny, you're absolutely right. We would never, for instance, have been allowed to make the cover of Happy to Meet and Sorry to Part, because it was grossly uneconomic. And in fact, it's a story that when Atlantic signed us. They signed Happy to Meet and Sorry to Part. And it's a true story. Mick Jagger, who was trying to get the Sticky Fingers cover together and who'd been told he couldn't have a zip, brought in the Horslip Seconds and went, you've just signed these guys, and if a cockamamie Irish band can have a cover like this, I can have a zip in me trousers. That apparently is a true story. So, you know, our part in the Rolling Stones' rise to fame.
Exactly. I look forward to their coffee table book, you know, with your picture on the front. But it's just that, and I have to tell you, I maybe told you this before, it was a source of pride to a whole generation, but that when you had the album in your hand, this band's from down the road. You know, this band are getting played on the radio and they're from down the road. They're not the usual chart act that we hear from America or across the water or whatever. So were you aware of the whole groundswell of this band represent all of us kind of thing?
I think we were. One of the things is we made a conscious effort to always play the North. There was a period when playing the North, I mean,
and Rory Gallagher, and I think that was it.
That was pretty much it. I mean, there had been a, you know, the story up to between 1970 and 1975, there was a kind of a belief that you didn't shoot the piano player and that musicians were sort of immune from that class of behaviour. The Miami happened, things were never the same again. But, you know, we took the view, I don't want to make it sound noble, but we took the view that we weren't going to be bombed out of playing the places that, you know, we wanted to be able to play. And we weren't ever a sectarian band in that sense. We didn't sing rebel ballads, you know. We were very clear that the Ireland that we wanted to inhabit was an Ireland that allowed for division and diversion and the genuine differences that exist between people. Some of the albums are about that thing. And so we took the view that we were just going to keep, we were going to keep right on playing. And I'm very glad we did. We always, you know, one of the things is once you got playing, this was the best place to play. It's a fantastic place. We always got fantastic responses.
Yeah, but the Ulster Hall gigs are the stuff of legend, and the Whitla Hall and all that you played.
And
you
Cold
know?
Rain, and you know,
I supported you one night in Cold Rain, long time ago.
You're joking. I think we maybe talked about this. It wasn't the night that there was a little fracas afterwards,
yes,
was it?
Yes, that's right.
Some heavies burst in and started laying about them.
Yes, that's right. I was
Francie
in the support
Quinn
band.
Was the ENTS officer.
I think it was Francie, yeah. But I do remember that because I know there was a fracas.
And were you in the band?
I was the drummer in the support band.
Wow.
You know?
Oh, my God.
Do you remember that one night in Cold Rain?
You look much too young to have anything to do with that.
That was I dined out in that for years.
That was
supported Horslips, you know. So then that became played with Horslips, you know, i.e. on the same stage before they even got out of the dressing room, but played with Horslips was thrown in, you know. So
after that gig, we went to Belfast. in two separate vans, with both in University of Coleraine, two separate trannies in University of Coleraine Green, went for Belfast. One went the coast road and one went the interior, because there, we'd been told there was a there might be a problem for us. So we had two separate vans, and even at that, on the way coming into Ballycastle, we had a moment. So there was plenty of that thing at night, if you're on a long road and suddenly headlights flick into view behind you, and you know that the car's going to overtake event, and you kind of go, wonder who's in that car and what his intentions are. Yeah. Well, in the north, in the 70s, you really wondered that.
Oh, listen, when you're driving home at 2 and 3 in the morning, I know, that's Andrew. We did a lot of gigging then as well. But it was brilliant, you know. But I do remember the trouble you're talking about actually started. Our bass player was in the toilets, and he'd blew her at the time.
Yeah.
And a couple of thugs tried to sort of start with him, but they didn't realise that everybody else in the toilet was the rest of us and the road crew and all. So, but we could see it. That was happening even before we went on stage, So, but then
these guys were wielding iron bars.
At the end, I know it went. Yeah, just got ugly. But we got out of the road, so we were all right.
Although with blue hair, I think you're legitimate. I would have said,
deserve what the guests say.
Anything that happens to you, mate, that's your problem.
So listen.
Just before we go, what colour was your hair that night, Johnny?
It wouldn't be this dignified silver that it is now, no.
Would it have been blue?
No. I had normal kind of hair. Well, it was sticking up in the air and all, but it was normal. Listen. Tall Tales, the official biography. This isn't all good shops and all bad ones as well, I suppose.
I believe. Yeah.
We signed a bunch today, so if you want rare signed copies, they're in Waterstones.
In Waterstones, okay.
And they're all good bookshops, but there's a few signed ones up there. So.
Okay, no problem. Listen, boys, I can't thank you enough for coming in. It's really good to see you again.
Indeed.
And the CD, is this on general release as well?
It certainly is.
That's a collection of UK A sides and B sides, because there were a number of tracks that hadn't ever made it onto CD for one reason or another. Not a number, there was like 3 or 4. And there was a couple of single re-edits and remixes that had come out. And so they're finally compiled onto that. So that should put the remaining bits and pieces of the catalogue to bed.
No, that is brilliant. I'm going to finish with one of my favourites. But Barry, Jim, thanks for coming in, boys. Good
Thank
luck
you very
you.
Much.
Thanks, Johnny.
Cheers, night.